accession number 22572, reel 5.
Reverend Eliam Claxton, reel 5. You were describing how you got to across the Irrawaddy. You were saying that the Dorsets had to follow up a failed attack.
Yes, that's right.
By the Worcesters.
Well, we were on the banks of the Irrawaddy, on the north bank, going to river at that point running east to west. Ready to go across, you see. Not a nice position to be in, having knowing about the failure. Well, one company sergeant major came with me with a man who handed over to me. He said, this chap, it was actually Private Curl, the bell ringer, I think, if I remember rightly. This chap can't walk. He's lost the use of his legs. Will you take him back to the advanced dressing station? Well, there was I with this chap. I didn't know what to do with him. I could have helped him back. I didn't want to go back, quite honestly. One doesn't want to go back if all your comrades and mates are going forward. So I wanted to stay with them. I didn't know what to do with him, but I couldn't leave him there. So I thought, now this is obviously a case of shell shock or something, or, you know, nerves. And the best treatment for a nerve is to give the chap a smart slap on the face. So I stood him up temporarily and took an enormous swipe. But I just tipped the end of his nose. I didn't dare to hit him. But he was so surprised that the padre had actually tried to hit him that he didn't fall down. He stayed remained standing. The last I saw of him was that he moved off with the other walking wounded towards the 80th. So I was free to move. I saw him a few days later on the other side of the Irrawaddy, and he gave me a rather sheepish look, but that was as far as it went.
Did you come across many cases of men suffering from
nerves?
No, not many.
I came across one during the march into Schwebe. There was a chap, a young officer, who was still alive, by the way. We called him Jonah. He joined fairly late when in England, and he had a sort of a quite unnatural interest in cemeteries. And he would say to you, sitting at dinner, he'd say, do you know such and such a village? And you say, no, I don't. He said, well, it's a very interesting cemetery they've got there. This was, he's always talking about cemeteries. So we called him Rigor Mortis, Jonah. Well, in the advance into Burma, along the flat country, there were a lot of sort of roads, not roads exactly, but tracks, with hedges on both sides. And we heard that Jonah had been hit and wounded. So the doctor and I took a stretcher and we walked towards the place where he'd been hit, put him on the stretcher and carried him back. I thought he was dead. I really did think he was dead. He looked white as a sheet. And then coming down, as we passed, going the other way, was one of our own carriers, leaving very little room. We had to ease him through a gap with a carrier on one side and a hedge on the other. And my bit of stretcher must have caught his arm against the side of the carrier. And the corpse sat up to my delight and said, Christ, mind my bloody arm. Well, that's wonderful, really. He wasn't dead, he's still alive today. I had lunch with him the other day. That was funny, very amusing anyway. Then we got across the reward. We had a wonderful, at least a week, on a kind of island in the river where we swam, and we were doing nothing. We were just waiting to go forward.
What sort of craft, do you remember what sort of vessels or craft you used to get across the river?
Well, they were boats of some kind. They had a sort of outboard motor, I think.
Were these canvas boats or wooden boats? Do you remember?
Wooden boats, yes. Yeah. I think so. I can't remember really.
Do you remember who was driving them? Was it the infantry
themselves? The RAC were driving
them. RAC.
They were run by the RAC. They'd brought them up somehow. Got them across. They came down the river somewhere and put them in, I suppose.
Yes.
But they weren't our boats at all. We didn't have such luxuries. But we had this lovely time on this island. And I must tell you this. Tudeh had an idol, a woman idol called Frances Day. Mm. You would know her. She was a very famous actress. We fell in love with Frances Day when we were way back in France, in Roumégie. She came and appeared at a concert party and sang In My Wildest Dreams, You Are There on a Rainbow. Sort of. And then she joined Tudeh somehow. She managed to somehow way forward with an RAF plane. And she was on the other side of the Irrawaddy, with way in the Cross Keys. And she wanted to cross the river. She wasn't allowed to. The military police stopped her. But she did cross the other side. I used to have a picture of her sitting on a jeep in her Ensa uniform with the Cross Keys on it. Lovely person. What happened after it, I don't know. We were on this bank on the other side. These are the sort of periods in war when nothing was happening, you know. Mm. Had to make the best of it.
A lull.
A lull. We swam. Then we started moving towards Mandalay. 19 deer were coming down from the north. We were coming up the south. And the Japanese decided they'd had enough and were going. But before they went, they decided they would fire all their guns at us, all their heavy stuff. And we had one hell of a night. Most uncomfortable. When the I wasn't, no one, very few casualties, strange enough. I wasn't hit, but a shell landed not very far in front of me and completely buried me in rubbish and rubble. Very hard to dig in. You couldn't get down very well. But I was there buried.
Did you do your own digging at that stage of the campaign?
Yes, you had to go and dig. You had a shovel, one you carried with you. Mm. An entrenching tool, I think it was called. You did your best. And I was completely covered. Mm. And there was... when the salvo was over, the shelling stopped after a time, of course, the stretcher bearers came round to see what damage there was. Now, we had a bugler called George Cripps, who was a wonderful bugler. He played in the dance band, too. I knew him perfectly well. And he blew the long reveille in a most wonderful way. I don't know whether you like the long reveille or whether you don't, but it's much better than that horrid thing called the rouse, which makes you turn around and go to sleep again, or Charlie, which I think is equally bad. But the reveille really makes you want to get up and get going. And George Cripps had a marvellous way of playing it. Anyway, he came round, he saw this lump covered with earth. And I heard his voice say, I'd done with his long reveille actually at that point, but I didn't get that. I got his voice, which said, this poor bugger's had it. So I summoned what dignity I could. And I said, Corporal Cripps, I am not a bugger, and I have not had it. Will you kindly get a shovel and dig me out? But the story went round the battalion later on that I'd been found buried with my hand stuck out and pointing to heaven, saying, I believe in the resurrection of the body. Well, that was the last story. There's one more.
Did you find that when you were in action in Burma in these very hard conditions, that there was an increase in the interest in religion amongst the soldiers? Did it inspire them to be more?
Not really, not really. Mm. I think, yes, I had a church prayer then. I think they've come to it. Mm. Yes, I think there was a bit. But it wasn't all. We didn't talk about it much, you know. It was there underneath all the time, but it wasn't. We didn't speak about it. Life went on. Then the next thing was the 14th Army crossed over and went down the Irrawaddy to move the back. We never got to Rangoon. They got rid of the Japanese down there. We didn't bother about that. We were sent down to a mountain called Mount Popa, P-O-P-A, which was quite high. And this was the last battle that we fought in Burma. The Japanese were occupying Mount Popa. And they shared the occupation with the king cobra, the hamadryad, which is reputed to attack you on sight. It's an aggressive snake, large, very large snake, cobra. We never saw one, actually. But anyway, we came across the inevitable roadblock. And I said to you earlier that We had knew enough about warfare under these conditions not to attack a roadblock direct. We did a right hook, and we sat on their lines of communication behind, just behind them. Night. We couldn't dig in much because the ground was too hard. You could hardly get down. The two Cook's trucks came up, first light, and we had a merry time beating them up. We got a lot of them, actually, but the one last one didn't. Turned around, went back. Gave our position away. And then we had the usual barrage of shells falling around us. Again, a very uncomfortable night, but no, hardly any casualties. None at all, if I remember. But it was very nasty and uncomfortable. And in the morning, of course, the RAF took over again because they flew their planes and the guns were hidden. My batman and I were sharing a slit trench. Not my driver, another one. He'd gone off somewhere else, my original one, back to the RASC, I think. This was a real Dorset I had this time, and Penfold. He was digging away, or trying to dig away, about midday. And he suddenly stopped and leant on his shovel and said, "Excuse me, sir," he said, "how long are we going to be here?" I said, "I have no idea, Penfold. I think I sincerely hope not for more than another night." He thought for a long time. Then, in that case, sir, he says, I don't think it's worth digging this year hole any deeper. You know, it's not for nothing that on the public buildings in Dorchester, the county regiment, has got its motto, "Who's Afeard?" That was our last battle. Mm. Then we were flown back to India, Peshawar camp. Mm. And I can tell the tale from there, if you like. Mm. That's a good point to stop, really.
I think what happened when you got back from Burma and went into India again?
We went to Calcutta for a bit. And I was then able to make contact with a young nurse that I'd been courting slightly up in Assam. And then we moved to the middle of India, and I was promoted to senior chaplain, 2nd Division. And then I saw the division splitting up. This young woman who lived in Madras, she'd left the nursing service, so I was very keen to become senior chaplain Madras. And I asked for the job. I didn't get it. I got the senior chaplain Kalyan Transit Camp. Kalyan's a place where new arrivals in India used to go to. It's a very dull job, really. And fortunately, I did eventually get posted to Madras, to my great delight. And the other division, most of the division, went home. They did form a force, some of them, 5 Brigade, to go to Japan. But I didn't want to join that, so I decided to stay in India and look after my young woman. When I got to Madras, I found to my dismay that she'd got another boyfriend, so she'd broken her engagement, the first one, and so that was that. But I did take over Madras area, which is a vast area, including Cochin and Bangalore and Visakhapatnam, right up on the other coast. And I met there the lady who was running the mess, who was lent to the Madras mess because she really ran an officer's hostel in the Nilgiri Hills in a place called Ootikaman, where Dunmore actually, Kannur. And she'd been lent to Madras officer's mess to sort out the muddle they'd got themselves into. It was an extraordinary mess containing Europeans, Christians, Indians, Parsis, Sikhs, Hindus, Mohammedans. You know, it was an extraordinary mess, and it really was quite fun living there. She was a delightful character, this, and we got on like a house on fire. She had been married before. She lost her husband. He died some time ago. She went out to India in 1937 to teach and stayed on there during the war. And one morning, there was a little church which I used to take services in by the San Tome Cathedral, which anybody who knows Madras would recognize. Little garrison church. And I was there in the pulpit one day, and I heard an aeroplane dive bombing the church. And I thought this was extraordinary. When I got in the mess afterwards, early services, I found that it had been my dear friend, Irene, her name was, with a doctor who did a bit of amateur flying. And she said, that's the place, and he dive bombed the church. She was a great character, and it wasn't long before we started not making love or anything like that, but, you know, getting quite affectionate towards each other. And I said to her, what about getting married one day? She said, I'm not going to marry a vicar, she said. I said, I'm not a vicar, I'm a chaplain. She said, well, that's different. We did eventually get married up in Ooticommund. She went back to her job in Connaught to run the hostel properly, because her partner had retired, and we got married in Ooty. And she stayed on to finish off the job, and because I had to go home then. So I was without her about 3 or 4 months. I left her behind.
When you were still in India at that time, this was the time of the preparation for independence coming along. Did you get any sense of the political atmosphere in India at the time?
Not really. Not down in that part of the country. It's a very Hindu area, really. I think possibly up in Pakistan, there, that area, before the partition, of course. I'm sure there was, but it happened shortly afterwards.
Yes.
and it was absolutely a bloodbath, really. My wife had left India by this time, fortunately. And I met a lady in when I went to the last Burma Star service in Westminster Abbey, who was an Indian. I thought she was Burmese. She said, no, I was born in near Lahore. And she said, I said, I was very angry that with our government for letting that thing happen. They did it far too soon. She said, I was very angry with your army, because they could have prevented all that, but they wouldn't do it. They said they're not going to risk their lives, you know, in this sort of way. So that was a sad story, really, she said. Whether she was right or wrong, I don't know.
Did you see any signs of anti-British agitation anywhere? Did you see any signs of anti-British agitation in India?
I didn't get any anti-British agitation, frankly, because, mind you, as a British division, we're all British. We didn't mix very much with the Indian divisions or with Indian people, really, except in the bazaar. But they really are fantastic. I'll tell you one story. When we arrived this goes back before the Burmese War. When we arrived in India, the Indian High Command hadn't a clue what to do with us. Mm. And we were moved around from all over the place for a couple of months. This was Secunderabad. And I liked playing the piano. And I shared a bungalow there with a doctor. And I thought it would be rather nice if I could get hold of a piano to play in my spare moments. We went to the bazaar to buy some sports equipment, because I was also a sports officer. And when I said, quite casually, we were having a cup of tea as usual, any chance of hiring a piano? Not thinking, it's a kind of joke, really. And before I knew where I was being tapped on the shoulder by 2 or 3 people. You want piano, sahab? And you know, before I got back to my bungalow, the piano had been delivered. It's fantastic, the service there.
Another thing that happened was the end of the war as a result of the atomic bombs being dropped on Japan. Do you remember what you thought about that at the time?
The
atomic bomb attack on Japan. When you heard news of that, what was your immediate thought?
Well, where were we at the time?
Have been back in India, I think.
Yes, we were in India, yes. We weren't sort of horrified by the morality of it. I think we were very relieved that it really brought the war to an end, because the Japanese were tenacious fighters. I mean, they fought like tigers and, well, rats, really, underground in Burma. What they'd have done in Japan, if we tried to capture Japan and land forces there, is nobody's business. We were very conscious that we'd been spared an awful battle, an awful war. And the atomic bomb, of course, did it.
Another thing that's coming clear is that you seem to have decided that you wanted to remain in the army by this stage.
When I got married, I applied for a regular commission, and I got a regular commission. And eventually, I came back to India and was posted as senior chaplain in Colchester, East Anglia district. And it covered the whole of East Anglia. We had a lovely time there, and we were in a wonderful old Garrison church. And there my first child, a daughter, was born. Nothing much happened in Colchester, really. It was quite... My job, really, was to go around and talk up the vicars of those churches where we wanted to have church parades, because there were quite a lot of territorials in that part of the world, and we wanted to have a church parade every now and then. So it was a very interesting job in that way. I was a roving ambassador, in a way.
I was going to ask you, why it seems to me that you had fallen in love with the army, that you really did love being in the army, and I wondered what it was that had attracted you to it.
I fell in love with the army in Belgium, in France, when I joined the Dorset Regiment. I may have told you last time, I don't know, because for two or three days they thought I was a German spy.
Before and, your orders arrived.
Yes. Well, Hitler was using the dog collar to conceal his spies. And I had no idea I was suspected. And they were so nice to me. They followed me wherever I went. They wouldn't let me out of their sight. They always asked me questions. It was wonderful. I fell in love with the army then. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really mean to stay in it as a regular at that point.
What decided you to stay in it as a regular? Was it because you wanted to
Yes. Well, I think as part of my wife's remark about vicars and things, I didn't want to be a vicar. I never was a vicar, actually. When I retired from the army, I became a rector. So
can make a lot of difference.
Well, you know what a vicar is. He's in the old days, he was employed by the rector, who went hunting, shooting, and fishing.
The vicar
take his services.
Did the services. Yes.
Yes.
When you were doing your work in Colchester. Did you find that you got a good response from most vicars, most incumbents in the parishes?
The incumbents are very good. Yes, very good. I didn't have any problems at all. I used to have padre's hours, of course.
What did you use those for? What did you do during padre's hours?
Padre's hours. Well, you're supposed to talk about religion and convert people to the Christian religion, I suppose, but you talk about God and why we believe in God or why people don't believe in God. And we talked about the church. We talked about a bit of church history here and there. General sort of rundown on the Christian religion, really. And on morality sometimes, implied by that, of course.
What sort of moral issues would you discuss in particular with your...
Oh, goodness gracious me, you're taking me back a long time. I really can't remember, to be quite honest. anything which was in the news, I suppose, would spark off something. And we had discussions. I would give a little talk, and then we had a discussion.
So you'd be referring it to current affairs?
Yes, more or less, really. Mm. I think so.
Did you find that there was a change in the outlook of the soldiers once the war was over and...
Yes, there was. Everybody was rather bored. You see, the National Service was on, of course, and they didn't really like National Service much. I'll tell you more about that later on, because when I got posted from Colchester, I went to run a church house in Germany at a place called Preetz. Now, Preetz needs a little description. It goes back to the 10th century, I think. And the Duke of Schleswig-Holstein was a wonderful shot with a bow and arrow. He had never been known to miss. And he was out hunting in the woods one day near Preetz, before anything was there, really. And he shot at a stag and missed it. And he said to himself, "This is an omen from heaven. I must do something about it." So he built a nunnery there for nuns, a lovely place, really. And a wonderful church, a beautiful church, 13th century church. And then, of course, came the Reformation, and there were no more nuns, but they turned it into a home for spinsters. The idea was that the old nunnery buildings were pulled down. Of course, they built lovely, lovely great houses, about five great houses all round, round the tree where the stag was, still there, and a grass around it, and there the church is still there. And, of course, the Reformation, they painted out all the pictures in the church. There was one at the back of the, facing the altar, right at the back, covered up with another little altar, which was completely obscured. And the grey paint had been put on all the, you know, the sort of things, you know. Lovely stained glass windows. It had been bombed, and this became a church house. And we used to put soldiers into the houses of St. George's, St. Andrew's, St. Patrick's, St. David's, they were called. And each, we had a small British staff. Each one of the soldiers was a warden of each house, you see, looked after the soldiers when they came in. Well, when I got there, there wasn't very much happening. A small group of people would appear from time to time, but it wasn't a full-time thing, really. And the general came to see us, and we whitewashed all the stones we could see. We made a proper splash, really. And he walked around, was very impressed. And I said to him, "Sir, you know, we have national servicemen. They come to Germany to do their 10-week training, and then they are posted to various regiments. Would it be possible, when they finish their training, to send them here for 3 days? And bless him, he fell for the idea. So we were then inundated with 30 or 40 young national servicemen who used to come for 3 days. We had two sessions a week. It was hard work.
What did you do with them for those?
Well, we first of all, we opened the bar, and we made them very comfortable. They had a cup of tea in bed. That was part of the softening up process. I said to them at the initial talk, "You don't have to go to church, but we would like you to come to family prayers and to a service called Compline, a late-night service in the church." And they all came. I mean, nobody, hardly anybody stayed behind. I gave them a form to fill in, so I got some idea of who they were and what they were doing and what their background was. When they'd gone to bed, I used to work through these forms, and I'd form a syndicate, say three or four, about eight people in a syndicate, with a leader. I chose the leader from the forms I'd got in front of me. And we talked. I had a series of lectures, why I believe in God, the Bible, the church, and then morality and so on, etc. A series of four lectures. And then we had discussion after each lecture with the syndicates. I gave them questions to work out, and they gave a report, a syndicate report before lunch. Then they had the afternoon off. And in the evening, tea time, we had another lecture with no discussion after that. But then after supper, we had a film show. Then we went in the chapel to say our prayers and went all to bed.
Who provided you with lectures? Did you do all the lectures yourself?
Or yes,
did you?
It was hard work. They were the same lectures, of course, but given twice a week.
Yes.
And I knew them all by heart by the time I'd finished. I was there for 2 years. And it was a wonderful experience. And I'll tell you one thing which happened to me. When after I retired from the army, I was living in Pimlico, and the telephone rang one day, and a chap said to me, "You won't remember me, but are you the Reverend L.E.M. Claxton, Gus Claxton?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you won't remember me. I came to one of your courses in Preet's Church House, and something you said made me change my way of life." I said, "I was rather an agnostic." But he said, "What are you doing now?" He said, "Well, I'm the professor of theology in King's College, London." I said, "Of course." And Professor Holden, we've been great friends ever since. He's gone up the north now. But I thought that was some achievement anyway.
Well,
I was very proud of it.
Were the soldiers who came all volunteers?
No.
They were sent.
They were detailed. Mm. And some of them came with a very angry look in them. I said, look, you don't have to go to church. You must attend the lectures. But if you